Blog Talk Radio.
I've tried a thousand times to break down my door, and I've lied a thousand lies to try to get beyond these walls and chains that bind and hold me to the ground. I've cried a thousand cries, but no one hears a sound.
Good afternoon and welcome to Spotlight for Justice, a podcast from the National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation. I'm your host, Michelle Bart, and joining me in a few minutes is my co-host, Dr. Kathy Mathis, a national domestic violence expert. Today, we're going to shine a light on two epidemics in our society, domestic violence and homelessness. The call-in number for questions of our guests is 515-602-9601. Again, the call-in number is 515-602-9601. Today, we're going to welcome our guests. We have Kate Budd, who serves as the interim manager of Lane County Human Services Division in Oregon. Kate and N.W. Cave have known each other quite a while, for many years. Kate was the executive director of the Council for Homeless for years here in Clark County, Washington. We also will be joining, we'll also have part of the conversation, Nadia Lavendero, who is the president, founder, and executive director of Right to Protect, a national exempt nonprofit organization in California. The mission of their organization is to provide supportive services and resources to victims and survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking, and stalking. To learn more about their agencies, please visit our page at Blog Talk Radio. So today we have Dr. Kathy Mathis as our co-host. Kathy, are you with us?
I am with you. Thank you so much, Michelle. Welcome everybody who's listening to our show today, talking about very, very important things that hopefully you'll learn from and also will want to help us to resolve and solve for so many people out there.
Definitely, definitely. And before we begin the conversation, the intro music was donated to us years ago by our friend Anthony Mossberg. And so we thank Anthony for always lending his voice to the cause. So I'd like to bring on everyone, Kate and Nadia. Welcome to Spotlight for Justice.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you as well.
So I called Kathy a couple weeks ago and I said, listen, I just did an interview, which was very interesting to hear that a local, news outlet wanted to do a story on the epidemic of homelessness and domestic violence. But my perspective, as I've mentioned to all of you, is quite different than maybe the folks that lead the effort in organizations that deal in homelessness as well as domestic violence. We see things at NW Cave when individuals come to us because they want to flee or they want to leave a domestic situation, and all the shelters, at least in our neck of the woods, there are no beds available. and there's waiting lists, and no one's calling them back at different from different agencies, either in Oregon or Washington. And so when the reporter asked me some questions, I think I may have scared her a bit in my delivery, because my thought process on this is, in order to stop the epidemic from happening, we must be able to find creative means to reducing the issues that cause certain things from happening. So in this particular case, as we've seen in Oregon recently, why isn't Washington putting a cap on rents? Why isn't Washington being able to do the things that we need to do so a mother who has been not the breadwinner, but she is now leaving a domestic situation with her children, have to make 3.5 times the rent in order to qualify to move in somewhere? Why does the person that has nowhere to live in a car and has no address can't get a job? The little things that we should be able as a society to change in order to make things better for those that need the services that they need when they become homeless or they're in a domestic situation and they want to leave, but society and the perimeters that we have set for renting, buying, things of that nature. And also the numbers that we saw in the article that was published, I told her that it said 56%, that was a number of DV cases that skyrocketed after the pandemic. And for me, I said, those are numbers that are reported. The numbers, and that's the only thing I was quoted in, as saying, was I believe those numbers are much higher because you're not accounting for the individual that's sleeping on my couch or sleeping in someone's office or sleeping in their car. The numbers are only reported numbers. So what about all the other people that may have shame to admit what they're doing in order to survive and live? So that's my two cents, but you three are the experts. So Dr. Mathis, I want to turn it to you to get the ball rolling.
Okay, well, thank you for that, because I want to take it back even farther than where you went with it. So if she was frightened by you, she's really going to be frightened if she's listening in today. So let's go with this. Most domestic violence survivors that have to leave don't want to leave. It's their home. They've done nothing wrong. They have children. Where are they going to go? Who wants to take them when they have children? And again, our society is set up to punish them for being in a relationship where there's domestic violence. So our society from the get-go, when it comes to the connections of domestic violence and homelessness, sets it up to where they make a victim leave, not the perpetrator. Why on earth are you asking a woman and her children to leave her home when it could be just as easily mandated that in domestic violence, the batter is mandated to leave the home? That's one person versus two or more. First of all, that's just one thing. Second of all, why is it in our society that we have shelters that are put in place for women and children that they have to flee to for doing nothing wrong? That makes no sense whatsoever. And there was a study done from the National Center for Children in Poverty that said that the children and mothers that are homeless, more than 80% of them experience domestic violence. So that shows you our system is set up wrong to begin with. There is no way we should ever ask people to leave their homes when they've done nothing wrong and there's a perpetrator. they should be mandated to leave, number one. Number two, the other thing that I want to point out at this point in time is that in one of the research studies I was looking at, it said that on one given day, there were 31,500 adults and children fleeing domestic violence who found refuge in emergency shelters or transitional housing. That very same day where that 31,500 adults and children fled, the domestic violence programs they fled to were unable to meet over 12,197 requests for services because of lack of funding, lack of staffing, and other resources. That's outrageous. Totally outrageous. So we have a system, first of all, that re-victimizes the victim, and you and I have had many conversations about how the court system does it. And then second of all, our social services are not addressing the issue appropriately, and our federal government is not giving enough funding for the programs who actually provide the services to be able to cover the needs. So it is a huge dilemma that affects so many people, not only in one state, but all of the states across the United States. So that's where I'm going to start off with, that I get very, very upset when I know our system is set up and says, you know, when police officers show up, they'll say to the victim, well, you need to leave. Take the kids and leave. Why? Turn around and take that perpetrator and make him leave and make him stay in a shelter for himself. He can go to a homeless shelter, you know, and stop punishing the victims who've done nothing wrong. So, Nadia, what do you have to say about that?
Your
turn. Yeah.
So let's get this party started. So, you know, touching on the funding aspect that you just mentioned, one of the things that I've noticed, not only is the funding grossly underfunded, it's unavailable largely, but then the funding that is available, it's so restrictive that it renders the organization and program practically useless. Now, I've got a client who was fleeing their abuser. And unfortunately, my organization right now is not in a position to provide housing, so I had to refer them out to another organization, a rather large organization here in the state of California. And she had reached out to them, and they told her that, yes, they did have vacancies, but they couldn't take her because she was not a resident of that county. She was fleeing the county where, you know, her and her batterer were residing at the time. And they told her, unfortunately, because you don't currently reside in this county, we can't help you. The point she made was, well, if you allow me to stay there, I would then be a resident of that county. And they told her, sorry, you know, too bad, so sad for you. We can't help you. And I've come to find that, you know, that's one of the frustrations that I have with when it comes to funding anything that I want to do, is that the government funding is so restrictive that, again, it renders your organization, your programs practically useless, because you've got this bureaucratic board that sits up, you know, in their ivory tower with their, you know, fancy titles attached to their names, and that have zero experience, zero connection to the demographic that this funding is supposed to exist to serve, telling us here on the in the trenches and on the front lines how to best serve the needs of the victims and survivors. And that's a problem, because I don't have an issue with transparency or accountability. That's not the issue. But I'm sorry, you're not in a position, because me as a survivor and now, you know, running my own organization, I'm better equipped to determine how these funds that you give me best meet the needs of my clients. And another problem is that, you know, you've got these programs, these organizations that exist, but they only offer services that are funded by the government. And so if the funding's not there publicly through grant funding and stuff, you're not going to find it. And there's so many needs that need to be met that just are not considered by government funding. And that's just on the topic of funding.
Yeah, because that's one of the problems, is that what funding that there is there is always being threatened to take away. they've got better service, better use for that funding, or there's certain political parties that think, well, women don't matter, so let's not send the funding there. We can use it for something else. So that's a very good point as well,
right,
in the issue of domestic violence and homelessness.
Well, let me say that, you know, every year there's always a trend or what have you. And I may be off basis here, Kate, but it almost seems as if we've had a homeless issue for decades, for years and years. But all of a sudden in the last, you know, 3-4 years, it seems as if everyone's getting on the homeless wagon in order to apply for grants and say that they provide services. Is that just my perception, or is that what you're seeing in your line of work?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think that I would agree that there are more agencies than ever before that are looking to serve people who are houseless and, you know, also survivors of domestic violence and other challenges that they may be dealing with. And I think a part of that is because there is more money than there was 10, 15 years ago. And that, you know, for better or for worse, motivates folks to want to get into that line of service to try to help people. And I think sometimes people feel like, you know, they're the best entity to be able to help folks, and that they feel like their model is the strongest. Or it might be that people see an enormous gap and they want to work to try to address that gap and try to access dollars. You know, one of the reasons that we see so many more dollars is because of COVID and the recognition at the federal level that, you know, your neighbor, yourself, your kiddos, you know, someone who's close to you may have actually dealt with, you know, a housing instability issue. And we know that housing instability also leads to an increased risk of domestic violence. And so it was one of the first times in my lifetime that the federal government really stepped up and said, yeah, you know, we want to give dollars to everyone who is, you know, in a medium to lower income bracket to help support them during this really trying and challenging time. And that also meant providing more dollars to our nonprofits. And one of the challenges now is we're seeing those dollars decrease. And the ARPA dollars that went to, you know, all levels of jurisdiction is starting to wane. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, if the number then of nonprofits that are providing services also decrease a bit as well. I will also throw out that I started my career in the early 2000s, and at that point, I ran a hotline for folks to call who were in need of shelter. And folks who called who were looking to flee domestic violence, for example, it was realistic that through the amazing network of domestic violence providers across the Portland metro area, that we could find a place for a survivor to be. And I really appreciate the point that, ugh, I hate for survivors to have to leave their house at all. But at least, you know, in the early 2000s, it was a possibility that they could find a place to be, even if it was way out in Skamania County. And fast forward now to the, you know, 2020s, and that's just not realistic in any way. You know, no matter how small a community is, they have an enormous list of people within their county who are looking for shelter. And so that is one of the major differences that I've seen throughout my career. There also are kind of the challenge of domestic violence shelters wanting to serve people really well and making sure that they have their own room, that there's space available for pets and for their possessions and for the full family. And that means that there are actually fewer beds available than there might have been 15, 20 years ago. And so there's that dynamic of, you know, do we serve fewer people but serve them really well and in a trauma-informed way? Or do we serve more people like in a congregate setting where, you know, on some level we might be further traumatizing people, but at least we've gotten them with a roof over their head and out of their situation? And I think that's something that we're grappling with across homelessness services because we want to be as trauma-informed as possible, but we also want to serve as many people as possible.
But can, you know, with trauma-informed, with the homeless population, not everyone can do well having a roof over their head and in a traditional living situation. Is that correct?
You know, I would say that nearly every person can. The key is finding the best situation for them. You know, one of my favorite stories is someone who actually didn't have any interest in housing, but wanted to be a dancer, and they wanted a dance studio. And so my staff worked to try to identify housing that really was akin to a dance studio, and they presented it to this gentleman who had lived on the streets for decades and said, hey, what do you think? Is this a dance studio option for you? And he was ecstatic and immediately said, I'm not leaving. And so he moved in, and we conveniently had a bed to put in there. And he now, I check in with my staff because this is, you know, someone who really touched on my heartstrings. And he's still housed and doing well in his dance studio with regular case management support from an agency. And so I would argue that the vast majority of people would be successful in housing. We just want to make sure that they have the needed supports and have a really strong understanding of what motivates them to be strong in their stability.
That's definitely thinking outside the box. You know, that's not textbook, you know, ability to house everybody and everyone can do well. You found a niche where he could thrive. We saw in Oregon on one of the news stations recently a woman that they have followed for the last few years, and they got her housing and everything, but she's still struggling in her surroundings and still hoarding and you can't move in the apartment she's in. But again, with you, you were able to find what would make him happy and him being able to live in a place that he's always wanted to, and like a dance studio. That is creative
well, I think
means.
You bring
would
up
you,
a, sorry, Michelle.
Go ahead, Kathy. I was just going to ask you that.
Yeah, I want to say here that there are definitely mental health issues in the homeless community that we need to be aware of because there are some people, because of their mental health issues, that no matter what you offer them, they're not willing to go to those places. Also, a lot of victims, when you said at the beginning that there are, you know, the numbers are underreported, I believe that as well because there's a lot of women who won't leave and go because they think a domestic violence shelter is a homeless shelter, and it is not. It's different than a homeless shelter. And so we have people that have stigmas because of the word shelter. So one of the things that I did many years ago when I was running, you know, my domestic violence shelter programs is I always knew we had a waiting list because all of our beds were always full. So what I did was I got together with a lady in the community who had a passion and a desire to help women and their children that had to flee their home and was forced to because of a relationship terrorist. And what she did is she started a group in the community, and I thought this was really out-of-the-box thinking. She got together with a group of single women in that city area who had empty rooms in their homes, and they opened up their doors to taking survivors and their children and letting them stay in their homes in that room until we could find them shelter rooms. And it was a very interesting program that grew and grew. And what she did is she had us at the domestic violence program do the background checks and, you know, all of our due diligence in who these individuals were. And then they would get the list from us of who we had, you know, done our background and mental health checks with. And then these ladies would come and let them come and stay in their homes because they might have had children that had grown up and left, and they're in a house by themselves with three bedrooms. So each woman who owned a home or had a home and was willing to open up her doors would decide how many women and children she could take in there. And if the client had no money, they, you know, a lot of them wouldn't charge. If the client had some source of income coming in, then they would charge them to rent a room. And it grew and grew. And I thought that was really a neat, I think they were called Protective Moms. It was a nonprofit called Protective Moms who were trying to protect other moms and their children and give them a place to stay until we could actually get them into a shelter room. And a lot of them just ended up staying there and renting rooms from these ladies, you know, long term and got their jobs, et cetera. So when we're talking about this, I think thinking outside of the box is really important. But also people are afraid to take homeless people because we know that there's schizophrenia and other mental health issues that frighten a lot of people, and especially if these people are not on medication and they're not being case managed.
Well, that's a good question for both of our guests today in regards to mixing a community. We saw for years people try to open shelters. That's how we started. We wanted to open a shelter for human traffic victims. And we learned quickly that it's easier and probably more productive if we try to reduce the numbers of trafficking before we need a shelter. And so thus NWK was created. But we knew back then you could not and you should not mix your community. A human trafficking victim should not be in a domestic violence shelter. A human trafficking victim that is being rescued, police should not bring to a shelter that is mixed with both female and male. You know, and so we learned that some agencies the hard way, but we were able to learn that back then. Today, years later, are we still in the same place where, you know, so many shelters are for female only? We have a male domestic violence survivor and his four children. They're not homeless by any means, but if he needed shelter, where would one go? And the stigma and things of that nature, the same goes with homeless. If you have someone that's homeless by choice, are they necessarily, you know, aren't allowed to get help because they may be also a DV, you know, survivor and had nowhere to go but to be homeless in order to flee their situation? So, again, between the stigmas and all the things that we as a society put rules on, I believe the rules are actually preventing us from helping people. And I'd like to ask our guests to weigh in on that perception. And what would you do? What can we do to change where we're at? Nadia?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree what you're saying about the rules, because like I mentioned earlier, the restrictions on the funding make programs and organizations practically useless. The government's need to micromanage everything, and I understand why, to a certain degree, why that is, because, you know, you've got people, you know, out here, like was mentioned, you know, for good or bad, you know, regardless of their intention, we've got people out here that are in the joining the nonprofit sector for, you know, they've got malicious intentions. And mm-hmm. you hear about all these scandals about these, you know, nonprofit, you know, board members, you know, heading up, you know, these otherwise highly respected organizations that are embezzling money and all this other stuff. So, you know, you've got this issue of mismanagement of the funding, which, excuse me, I can totally appreciate and understand. But at the same time, there's got to be a balance. So, you know, we've got to start determining, like measuring our success by different measures, different barometers. Like, you know, you've got these organizations, whether they're well-meaning or not, you know, because funding is a numbers game. Okay, funding is a numbers game. So the more numbers you have coming in, the more funding you can justify when you apply for these grants. So their organizations have become almost like a revolving door. They're not really treating the individual and their trauma, and trauma-informed care is as unique as the individual and their trauma themselves. So you've got these organizations that it's almost like an assembly line. You bring them in, you supposedly address their issues, and then, you know, they're there for a short time and you send them off, and then what happens? The cycle repeats and they're back and nothing's really changed. So we need truly trauma-informed care in these places. We need organizations and advocates that are true advocates, not just people that are, you know, advocate by title to justify funding, people that are actually interested, educated, informed, experienced. Now, I am an avid proponent for survivors becoming advocates and getting in the trenches with these people. But we need to raise the standard of the treatment and care that we provide these people. We need to educate them on domestic violence and batterers, the dynamic of abuse. We need to, really empower them so that way they can start to actually heal and recover from this trauma, make better decisions. They're not stuck in the trauma bond cycle. Educate them about what the cycle of abuse and their experience actually does to their brain. You know, a lot of these people a lot of these victims that leave their batterer, that go back time and again, it's not just because the resources aren't there, but it's that the resources that exist are lacking. They don't understand that they're dealing with a physiological addiction within their brain to their abuser and the abusive cycle. So they're trauma bonded. And sometimes these things ain't never going to change. Mm-hmm. Some trauma bonds, like Dr. Kathy, I'm Dr. Kathy's protege. Okay, I'm going to say that. I'm going to name drop right now. The bulk of my certifications I've gotten through her, and she's a wealth of information. And she's not just my trainer, but she's my mentor. And there's a lot of things that she taught me that you will not find. Advocates and organizations, all these places that exist, big names, big funding, all that, they don't provide this to people, so they're scared, they're confused, they don't understand. They don't provide them with the tools to actually prevent themselves, help to prevent themselves from actually repeating these things. And mm-hmm. and you know, and then when talking about, you know, about the education, well, the judges, the mediators, the district attorneys, all of them, they're not educated. They're ignorant as hell. And that's not necessarily their fault, because the education that does exist that is currently mandated to them is extremely superficial.
You're talking from the perspective of DV victims and survivors that you see, correct?
I see, and I've had this conversation with Dr. K, and, you know, mm-hmm. I've talked to other true advocates, and so
it's a major,
you know, this
epidemic
is, talked,
in itself.
Yeah, and so it's not just a multifaceted issue. It's very nuanced.
It
And it's extremely frustrating because we've part of the problem is, like Dr. K said, you know, you've got the courts and law enforcement that are expecting the victim and their children to leave. Where are they supposed to go? What are they supposed to do? If they ain't got no place to go, well, guess what? They're stuck where they're at, and they're not going to make the batterer leave. And these people, these victims have been isolated from their family and friends, so it's not like they can just go to their mom's house. They can't just go to their best friend's house. They ain't got a best friend. They've been isolated. It's methodical. It's part of the part of the abuse. It's part of the cycle to keep them imprisoned in this, you know, relationship terrorism, as Dr. K had mentioned. So, you know, we need to start educating and really pushing to educate, because as soon as the judges and the mediators and the law enforcement and the district attorneys and the private attorneys, as soon as all of these people start getting a real, true, comprehensive education on this issue, we're never going to see real market change. We're not, unfortunately.
You are Dr. K's protege. Definitely, because you're preaching to the choir, sister. My goodness.
Amen.
Yes, that is the issue that we're seeing here 24/7 with our clientele, and it's
right.
It's almost
Absolutely.
As if the perpetrator does their doing, and then the system re-victimizes
the victim. Right, but the reason why the perpetrator is able to take the kind of control and power and control over the situation and the victim that they do is because of the ignorance of the system. Now, we're always going to have those people within the system that just really don't give genuinely don't care. Okay, unfortunately, there's always going to be those kinds. But as long as we can shift the majority, okay, the majority of those that are in the system, the judges, mediators, again, law enforcement, private attorneys even, district attorneys, advocates, because, again, I remember Dr. K and I were having a conversation. She was on a committee for a state organization, like a leader, quote-unquote, in domestic violence, and she was talking to them, and she had mentioned how, you know, none of them are educated in batterers. They're not even really educated in domestic violence, but they're not educated in batterers. And they have the audacity and the arrogance to claim to assert to Dr. K that they didn't need that. No, I'm sorry. But as a survivor, as an advocate, I tell you, you most certainly need to be educated in batterers, because until you actually understand the dynamic and the mindset and the type of people that you're dealing with on the other side, you're at a loss. And when I started training with Dr. K, she said, get your advocacy, get your batterers, and get your anger management. Okay. And I did that.
Yep.
And so, you know, I'm highly educated, and I'm also a survivor myself. Like, I escaped domestic violence, spousal rape, and stalking from a law enforcement family. Okay. So I tell people I understand police brutality on a whole nother level that most people can't even begin to comprehend. And so, you know, I've navigated this system, and I've been homeless with my children, and I, you know, I've lived all these things out, and through all of that, I understand in a very intimate and personal way how lacking the system is. It leaves so much to be desired. But then you've got these government, you know, bureaucrats and all of this stuff, you know, deciding funding and how to use it and all this other stuff. Nobody really truly asks survivors, how can we best serve you?
And that's
because really at the bottom line.
Yeah, I was just going to say sorry to talk over you, but
no, you're fine. I'm sorry.
You know, we can't see each other. So what I was going to say was, and that's a very good point, because we do have a lot of people sitting in positions who've never been there, never done it. They think they know everything without proper training, and they're making mandates on funding and programming and requirements that if they would have asked somebody who actually knows something, would have said to them, you know, I know your heart's in the right place, but your head's not, because you don't have
right.
the full understanding that you need. So with that
right.
being said, I want to say, Kate, what do you find, you know, in the work that you're doing, also that are some of the challenges, but also some of the suggestions that you might also have for overcoming some of the challenges?
Sure. So the first job that I had in this field was at a women and children's shelter. Most of the women were DV survivors fleeing from pretty traumatic situations. And the one thing that sticks with me very strongly is that in that shelter, boys over the age of 12 were not allowed. And when I think about poor decisions on behalf of someone, that is high up there. Idea of a parent having to leave their child in the midst of fleeing a DV situation, going to an environment that they do not know, and then having to send their son to a different environment just because they happen to, be over the age of 12 is horrific to me. And fortunately, that actually became outlawed at the federal level over 5 years ago at this point. And so that does not happen anymore, at least with federally funded programs. And I really appreciate everything that was shared as far as the importance of not just, providing shelter to someone, that the education and the supports are imperative. And when I think about, what would be the ideal situation in my mind is, while shelters are important and they're, they provide that immediate availability when there are beds available for a household who's fleeing domestic violence, what is more important in my mind is stable, ongoing housing where, someone has an opportunity to just really, sit back and breathe and start to plan around what does their life look like moving forward and how do they work on having that healthy perspective that will benefit themselves and their family moving forward. And so I often think about there are VASH vouchers, which are, project-based vouchers that provide ongoing rent assistance to veterans. And I would love to see that for DV survivors, where that you have regular rent going toward an apartment in perpetuity for as long as you have lower income. So that helps a household just stabilize. And then having those really important ongoing supports available to that household to help them, either relearn or learn the skills and healthy relationship practices that one needs in order to be able to move forward. So that would be my ideal world. I think it would also help to make sure that shelter beds were available when needed, because we could move people out and into housing much more quickly. So if I ruled the world, that's
one thing. Well, you brought up a point that I would. Oh, I'm sorry. I just wanted to follow up with a point that you made, and that is, stable, ongoing housing and stipend to help, a survivor of domestic violence and her children or a male survivor and his children with stable, ongoing housing and assistance. One of the problems with being a survivor of domestic violence is, you may have that, but you also have a legal case going on where a perpetrator is using the court system to financially abuse you. It's called court abuse, as we all know. And so you're having to pay huge sums of money to an attorney, and then you've got to pay your rent and take care of your kids. So there's an added stressor for survivors of domestic violence, because there is, I just learned of an agency in, I think it was the Carolinas, that actually their whole sole purpose is to try to help victims of domestic violence with their legal fees. But most states don't have anything like that. Most states will offer, if they even have this, a small stipend, in a legal defense for a victim of domestic violence in family court or criminal court or civil court, whatever she's in or he's in, to help them with that. So you have the added, we can, let's say we find them stable ongoing housing, but they have a legal case going on that's draining all the money that they're getting for their housing into defending themselves in the courtroom. And so that adds, I think it was Nadea said, it's a multi-pronged problem Because
absolutely.
In domestic violence, there's so many other things that come in that a normal homeless person is not dealing with, because
right.
their homelessness is not coming from domestic violence. So I love your idea, Kate, of, you know, yeah, let's find them ongoing, you know, stable housing, but let's also find them then the ability to survive while they're going through their court case, you know, mm-hmm. to be able to help them so they don't have to decide, you know, between a roof over their head or getting custody of their children in the courtroom.
And that's my, you know, like I said in the intro, my whole thing, and I told the reporter this as well, dear, I sold my home. My mother lives with me. So the two of us, we sell our home, and then we find ourselves in this big pickle that because I'm an executive director of a nonprofit, I don't make 3.5 times the rent, then all of a sudden we can't find anywhere to live. We had to buy a cabin with cash in order to have a roof over our head. And yet we had, you know, lots of money in the bank from the sale. I have a job, you know, we have resources, credit, everything. And none of that made a difference. Furthermore, not only was it bad enough that we could not get into any place that didn't have a waiting list, we weren't able to just write one application fee. We spent over $1,200 on applications, getting denied left and right. My credit score was close to 800. We had cash resources, a job, everything, and yet we couldn't qualify for anything. And so for me to see that, me in the face last summer, it made me feel, what if I were fleeing and I had never worked? What if I had a job or had 3 jobs, but I didn't have the credit? All of these things started coming through my head, because now all of a sudden I found myself selling my home of 12 years to buy something new, and we just wanted a stable place for a couple months to figure out where we wanted to go, and we couldn't do it. So how do we expect a mother or a father or man, woman, whatever the case may be, that's fleeing a domestic situation, or someone that lost their house in a fire, or any scenario where then we're at crossroads where the system and society is making the homeless problem what it is. And that's why I said in the intro, I believe we should, as a system-wide, be able to put a cap on rents. Put a scenario where you go to the housing authority and you get your background checks and you fill out your application, and that application is good for any place that you apply to, instead of mm-hmm. having to pay $50, $75, $100, one place was $200. You know, just for background checks. And another issue that I have discovered as well, and again, it all encompasses itself. I was in line at Ralph's here. It's Fred Meyer. But I was at Fred Meyer here, and someone was trying to use their, what is it, EPT or
EBT, electronic transfer.
Yeah, they were trying to use their food stamps to buy some food. It covered soda. It covered a pack of gum, but it wouldn't cover the cooked chicken. And
yes,
I was like, it will cover raw chicken, but it won't cover cooked chicken. What the heck? These are the simplest things that would cost nothing for us to adjust to be better servants and better community for those in need. And yet we choose not to do it. And so those are the little things that I'm on about changing now, because, you know, I hear, let's do housing. No, we're going to need billions. Let's do this. Or people that tell you, hey, they're a bad seed. Why are you giving them that grant money? And then they hightail it out of town with all the money and 40 families are homeless. You know,
right.
These are the things that all of you have been saying today. And that is, we need to do this together with people that have the right passion and the right purpose intact and the right agenda, because human
right.
lives depend on it. Human
oh,
lives
absolutely.
Depend on it. And these are simple things we can change as a society that we can actually maybe slow down the bleed and tighten that tourniquet just a tad bit in order to slow things down, but we choose not to. And government officials choose not to. Elected officials talk about homeless on every campaign, but they don't talk about, let's do this to slow it down. And yet that's what's ticking me off. So had to throw that out there. Kate and Kathy know me very well. And and Nadea, trust me, girl, I can't wait to meet you when I come to California in November. So.
Oh, well, that'll be fun. So it looks like Dr. K, me and you have a date to schedule. I haven't had the blessed opportunity to meet Dr. K in person either yet. So we've been working together for, 3 years now? And I still have yet to meet her in person. So I'm definitely looking forward to the opportunity.
Oh, awesome. Awesome.
Thank you. I look forward to it as well.
You know, how can, and you've been in the scope of, you know, working in these agencies in both Oregon and Florida, Oregon and Washington. You know, what small steps can we take in order to stop the issues that are fastly over becoming overly uncontrollable?
So I think a few things. You know, you mentioned basically the importance of the upstream programs, and recognizing that if you can help a family, you know, whether it's you know, not have to have someone flee domestic violence, and you know, be able to have a family, you know, identify what types of supports they need prior to things getting, you know, out of hand, or if we can help stabilize families in housing, if we can help, you know, families be able to earn enough income to be stable and housing continues to skyrocket, that just helps to reduce the overall much greater challenges that households face through domestic violence and houselessness. And then I think the other piece is just the recognition of the systemic realities that we face each and every day. You know, whether we're looking at, you know, racism, if we're looking at, you know, other enormous challenges that we deal with as a society, and we're not working to address those, then we can expect significant changes when we look at, you know, houselessness and we look at reducing the number of people experiencing domestic violence. And so we have to, you know, very much work to lead with race in mind and helping to progress, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and be social justice warriors moving forward, and make policies based on those ideals, and not just kind of continue to do the same old, and not recognizing that each piece of the puzzle is connected to the bigger picture, would be my greatest recommendation, and also just to recognize that when we're pushed to a point of scarcity, which is our reality, you know, whether we're looking at survivors of domestic violence or people who are houseless, you know, then it is very difficult to be able to, you know, address the presenting needs. And so how do we move out of that scarcity reality and be able to more effectively serve people in a trauma-informed equitable way as we're moving forward, and that, you know, that is demand that we need to make at all levels of government, recognizing that on some level the biggest funder of homelessness services is the state and not the federal government, and you know therein lies some other major challenges. But
I was going to say there's a can of worms.
Yeah, but right. How do we get a work at all levels to increase resources and to make sure that we're looking at, you know, both the upstream and the downstream realities from an equitable lens?
Definitely. What about you, Nadea?
I think we need to bring the humanity to the issue. Like I said before, I'd mentioned that funding is a numbers game, and so the victims and survivors and the people that these grants are intended, quote unquote, a term I use loosely, to serve are just numbers, you know. And I think we need to remember that these people have real life experiences. They've got traumas that they're contending with. They've got broken hearts and broken families and broken dreams. And, you know, I think, you know, there's a lot of guilt and shame, and we need to just remember that we're dealing with people, you know, we're dealing with real people and real lives here. And, you know, if we were to change the standard by which we measure success, I think, you know, that would be one way to really affect some serious change. But then we've got to convince our lawmakers and our legislators that, you know, that they're accountable to us, you know, because we elect these people into office, and once they're in office, few if any of them actually listen to us anymore. So, you know, I think we need to, you know, we need to start holding them accountable and really bring humanity back to the issue.
Definitely. Any last thoughts as we close out the show, Kate?
I think just simply to recognize that each and every one of you know the folks that we're talking about today, you know, are human beings, and that just simply recognizing them and being kind to them is very impactful, because that rarely happens, and the absolute like horrific things that happen to folks who are houseless day in and day out are just awful. And so the more that we can, you know, just be kind is you know, the way that we can help them know and remember that they are, you know, an important person, an important part of our community.
Definitely. And I believe that every one of us is a paycheck away from being there. So,
absolutely.
You know, and folks just need to keep that in mind. You know, and I think like we have an active missing children's division, and so many times we're on a particular case in Portland that we'll be releasing to the media soon. There has been a 14-year-old and this isn't the first time we deal with this all the time, but there's a 14-year-old that has not been seen or heard from in a month. There is a case, but nothing has happened with that case. No one has been interviewed. there hasn't been an email to the media saying the police are asking for the public's help. Nothing. She's 14 years old. So I don't care if she's with somebody under 18, over 18. The fact is she's a 14-year-old. If the parents had not reported her missing, the parents would be neglectful and there'd be issues with that. But if they report her, they get no help from law enforcement. But again, she's 14 years old. So even if she's a runaway, she is still out there and no one has heard from her. She deserves to be looked for. And I think so many times that we see in our caseloads that we put the stigma on the kiddos, and ultimately they now are statistics of the homeless population. They could be running away from people, or they could be running to somebody. But until we find them and decide on what the circumstances were, every single life deserves to be looked for. And when we're in a society that picks and chooses who they help, who they look for, you know, who they're kind to, who they give a cooked turkey to or a raw turkey to, and again, we need to change the rules of the game. We're not a century year old. You know, things have changed. Laws, rules, the Constitution, everything has changed. And the victims need to have a voice. And that's what we continue trying to do. And that's why we felt it was imperative to bring this conversation full circle with two fabulous women that obviously, you know, have a lot to say, and we're here to support you. So if your agencies need anything, you know where to come. Kathy, any last thoughts before we close out?
Yeah, I would like to just wind up. First of all, thank you, Kate, and thank you, Nadia, for being with us today and, you know, helping us with this very important topic that, you know, people need to know about and hear about. I would also like to say, if there are any listeners out there and they have caught our passion and they have caught the desire to want to do something, then be part of helping us to make the change by joining Homeless Task Force, Domestic Violence Task Force. Get on committees for the mayor of your city or for the governor of your state, those types of things, because change happens because somebody from the inside made it happen. One person can make a difference. Two people can make a bigger difference. Three people, and so on. And that's how change happens. And I hope that our passion and our desire and our love for our fellow human beings has ignited a passion in somebody listening, or many people listening, so they'll want to go out and join us in making a difference for people who need our help.
Exactly. Well, thank you, ladies, for joining us. If you'd like to learn more about Lane County's Human Services Division or Right to Protect, go to blogtalkradio.com/NWCave to learn more about their agencies. Share the podcast, share the conversation, share the links. Social media works if you work it the right way. Thank you again, Kate and Nadia and Dr. Mathis. As always, thank you so much. And we will see everyone and speak to you later in the month. And keep watching for our future shows coming up on Spotlight for Justice. So we leave you by saying, how are you going to shine a light on the injustices in your community. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day.